Hello and welcome to the ZMM podcast. My name is Hokyu. It's May 12th, 2024. And we have a little something different for you today. Now, if this just showed up in your podcast feed and you were expecting a Dharma talk, well, don't adjust your headset just yet, because once in a while we present a conversation about Zen practice or some new development in the Mountains and Rivers Order. And it's been some time since we've offered such an episode. But after this past weekend's retreat, I just couldn't pass up the opportunity to speak with today's guest. Vangeline is a performer, choreographer, and the founder of the New York Buto Institute. She also has her own company, Vangeline Theater, presenting innovative expressions of this avant-garde dance theater discipline, or however you want to classify this difficult-to-categorize creative phenomenon known as Buto. And beyond traveling the world offering workshops and performances, Vangeline is also a scholar of Buto, having published a book on the topic in 2020. You can find a review of that book, Cradling Empty Space, in the show notes, along with other links to Vangeline's work. Meanwhile, here at Zen Mountain Monastery, we've been fortunate enough to have Vangeline offer several Buto workshops over recent years, offering retreatants an opportunity to step into the Zen cloister while investigating the body, deep relaxation, and activation using techniques specific to Buto and to Vangeline herself. She's also concluded each of these retreat weekends with a solo performance, and we started off our conversation discussing the piece she presented on Saturday night and how it came about. We go on to talk about some of the history of Buto, its therapeutic applications, particularly related to trauma, and some of the diverse methodologies Buto instructors have used to bring their students to deeply embodied insights along with excellence in their craft. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. We recorded in the monastery's Sangha house on Sunday morning during caretaking practice, so you may hear a distant vacuum cleaner in the background from time to time. As they say in radio, stay with us. Well, first of all, I'll begin by welcoming my guest, Vangeline, to the ZMM podcast.
Thank you.
So wonderful to have you. So this weekend, we just completed a retreat that you led on Buto. And the weekend concluded with a performance of a piece that you designed called The Biggest Wave.
The slowest wave.
Okay. Referring to delta and other brain waves that have been found within Buto performers especially when they're accessing alternative states of consciousness. And you have collaborated with scientific research teams, particularly at the University of Houston most recently, to perform this piece with others. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, part of the impetus, the drive to do these studies to try to find out, because we don't have any data. Buto is an art form that is so niche, that is so small and so misunderstood. You know, it started as grotesque and people think mostly of the aesthetics of Buto and they don't really appreciate that Buto does have therapeutic value when we work with students and dancers. But there's no data, and there's very little data offered in dance in general. Mm. So we shall see. At the moment, we don't really know. I had my own intention or desire in conducting this study to find out mostly what's happening in our brain when we're dancing Buto. And can we actually prove or demonstrate that this is therapeutic and healing, a healing modality. Mm-hmm. Of course, as a practitioner, as a dance teacher, I've come to that conclusion because I, even this weekend, in 2 days, I can see how profoundly people are affected when they engage with the art form. Yeah. But it is a subjective point of view. It's not scientific. So having data and having science involved can also drive more awareness, bring more funding. It's important, I think. So that's kind of my view. And I don't know, I've been performing around the world now in festivals and in all types of different contexts. And it's always surprising to me how people react. Because for the most part, people respond on a human level. I think there's something so deeply human about Buddha, if a Buddha performer goes that deep within themselves, into their own humanity, I think we cannot help but respond. You know, maybe some people lose interest. I can see sometimes or hear people fidgeting in their chair or like, you know, like...
It's a practice.
It's a practice. Yeah, it really... If someone is moving this slowly, you can feel and hear as a performer. I feel everyone in front of me on stage. I feel the energy of the audience. And you can feel this restlessness. But then gradually, you can also feel that settling, like dust settling down. So there's a gradual effect that either people surrender or, I don't know, or they suffer. So maybe that's kind of the medicine of Buddha for the audience. You know, suffer or surrender. These are
suffer or surrender.
These are your choices.
Which could also be said of meditation, of your time on the cushion. And as you know, I'm always up for a conversation about the commonalities between Zen practice and Buddha. Mm. But perhaps before we go there, I kind of wanted to go back to, well, one commonality, which is the shared lineage from Japan. And so, you know, Buddha emerges in the early 1950s, mid-1950s, and develops from there. And many outsiders in particular, perhaps for... especially for a time, saw it as a emerging from and a reaction to the national trauma of World War II. And I'm sure that was somewhere in the consciousness of Buddha's founders. And actually, I was fascinated in your book, the connections with France that I was not expecting at all, that, you know, some Japanese modern dance performers and choreographers had been visiting France. There had been some cross-cultural connections, and particularly the work of mime. And could you talk about that for a minute? I mean, it must have been something that you didn't know originally when you
I did not know, and it was a great surprise to me to find that out. And I found out actually after I had already engaged with Buddha and I had responded so profoundly to it. You know, I viewed it when I saw it for the first time as a Japanese art form because I saw the company Sankaijuku perform and they were Japanese and four men. And I was like, oh, this is uniquely Japanese. This is why it's hitting me this way. And then I found out that at the very, very beginning, yes, there was cross-pollination. And, you know, I knew that there was the influence of German expressionist dance and modern dance, but I didn't know about French mime. Mime corporel dramatique, which is a very particular branch of French mime, which was focused on inner experience as opposed to being theatrical and histrionic. It was more about feeling and then moving. And that's based on the work of Étienne de Croux, who was very influential in French theater. And, you know, that's at a time where cinema was really gaining speed and people were looking for ways to train for the camera, where there's more subtle expressions on the face and things are felt and not, you know, you're not like acting on stage in front of people and miming an emotion or demonstrating an emotion.
So and Artaud was the master of that.
And Artaud was a master of that.
Much better known here than...
Yes, and Artaud was also a friend of the crew. They all knew each other, so... This cross-pollination, it was really amazing to me. And when I saw videos of De Croo, I could not believe it because I could see the beginning of Buddha. And I showed it to my main master, my teacher, and he also said, wow, I had no idea. And many Buddha dancers from the second generation did not know. And partly because there was that, you were talking about Buddha arising out of World War II. But yes, it was also a process of messy experimentation where people were trying stuff and trying this and trying that. And also kind of like with a little bit of infighting and this is mine. And as you, you know, let's talk about the ego since we're in a Zen monastery for a moment.
Sure.
as people trying to create something new, there's also, you know, the clinging to this is mine and I'm developing this and that's my form. And but they borrowed from a lot of different disciplines and people. And when we see that phenomenon, Buddha lineage, of sort of pretending that that these phenomenon did not exist, and that this is my buto and my art form. Nice. And I developed that. So, and as a result, there's a phenomenon of erasure of these influences, which is not very Japanese, because Japanese culture in general is very respectful of lineage. So now there's a return to lineage, but there's been a loss along the way where a lot of practitioners don't even know. For example, this weekend I was teaching some Noguchi Taiso exercises from Professor Noguchi, who was very influential on Buto. And Senkai Juku is a company that exclusively trains in Noguchi Taiso, but the word Noguchi Taiso never is pronounced in any of the workshop. Some of the dancers, younger dancers, don't even know who
that's what they're doing.
They don't know. They say this is the Senkai Juku method. And so Yoshigo Agatsu, God rest his soul, he just passed away. We lost a great Buto master. I have to imagine that he did not really introduce the work of Professor Noguchi to his dancers. It's only an assumption, but I see that a lot. And that's very interesting to me, this attempt for people to claim their territory and not give credit where credit is due. Or, you know, it's kind of the wild, wild west, Buto, a little bit.
I mean, that does seem to some extent to be a symptom of modernism as well, where there, you know, first of all, it emerges from capitalism and a need to carve out one's own niche so that people will value it as a creation of originality. And there might be some fear that arises that if you're known to be borrowing too much, that, you know, it somehow devalues what you're doing.
That's a good point. I mean, it's possibly what happened. I don't really know. I know that there was a lot of infighting and also a lot of support and collaboration, but a lot of competition. So it's a legacy of the Buto lineage that we are trying to move away from today, which is something that I view as very patriarchal personally.
Sure. Well, so, you know, speaking of how Buto has been developing and the things that you emphasize, one is a trauma-informed pedagogy of working with people. And so I wanted to ask you kind of about your journey in that, you know, what your personal research was like to get to the point where you felt as though you understood trauma enough as it arises in different ways in order to work with people. It's something that comes up in spiritual communities as more and more are emphasizing that approach, emphasizing having an awareness, because like Buto, there's, I would say, you know, a history of, how do we say, measures to get the individual to let go of any attachments to the self at the expense of their own personal feelings and what might be coming up for them, right? And that has been beneficial for so many people within the world of Zen going back centuries and within Buto. And it has also excluded people for whom that just wouldn't work because of their own histories, because they need to approach it in a gentler way, or there needs to be more awareness around where they're coming from. So yeah, I'm curious how that evolved from the earlier generations to your work.
Well, I think if we speak of the earlier generation, which is Tatsumi Hijiketa and Kazuo Ono, their interest was absolutely not therapeutic. Their interest was creating a new art form, and their interest was creating work. And by, in the case of Tatsumi Hijiketa, by any means necessary. And he, you know, these, I talk about this in my book, it was called The Ways of the War. So Tatsumi Hijiketa was very well known for being extremely cruel and sometimes violent with his dancers. You know, there's a famous incident of a dancer who was performing on stage in Tokyo and stepped on a nail and shriek in pain, and he said, "That is Buto." Or a dancer who was so exhausted from training that she started crying, and he told her, "If you have energy to cry, why don't you laugh?" Like, he was well known for pushing and pushing and pushing people. Many people left, they couldn't handle this kind of brutal training. And Kazuo Ono, on the other hand, was very happy, very loving, very kind, very generous, always in touch with the spiritual world. And he created an environment that was the opposite. That's why they're typically considered, like, you know, we talk about light and darkness and the polarity in Butoh between Hijikata and Ono. But even in the case of Kazuo Ono, I don't think he was interested or even curious very much about therapy or trauma. Or this is not something that was acknowledged. And then when I studied in the late 90s, early 2000s with my teachers who were mostly men, they had received those pedagogical methods which were kind of brutal and violent themselves. And I suffered greatly from being pushed. And, you know, one of the teacher would say, until the ultimate consequence, push yourself, you know, it didn't matter if you traumatized, re-traumatized. There was one workshop where we was in a sand pit in Mexico and I had to run backward and my head hit violently another student and I blacked out. And when I came to, I was given a boulder and told, dance now. And never taken to a hospital, and I had like a concussion as a result. So I encountered brutal, brutal methods. And I was being told as I was encountering these methods that if I had any problems with them, that it was my own failing, that I was not committed enough. So there was no room for questioning these methods coming from the male lineage, side of the lineage. And then I encountered women teachers who were kinder and gentler and really interested more in technique. It was less punishing. And I started thinking that something was not quite right.
And they were also squarely within the lineage. They had also studied.
They were within the lineage. They had, but they had made a choice. It was very clear that the way of teaching was different. Yeah. There was less of an attachment to violent methods, to ego. And then around that time, I became interested in trauma. And I think it's not so long ago that I realized that I myself suffer from complex PTSD. And once I understood and started seeking treatment for it, I understood that for me to place myself in these types of situations was actually re-traumatizing. And once I understood that I was suffering from PTSD and I started working in therapy and becoming curious about that, especially as a woman, because trauma affects women and men differently. It's also gendered, you know, the impact that it has on the female brain, and it's been documented. I understood that I had a responsibility because I was already teaching not to pass these methods and re-traumatize people. And so it's twofold. It's me in my personal journey as an individual understanding that I suffer from PTSD. And so that gives me a unique edge and position. And I also have tools to help people. And there were people in the workshop this weekend that suffered from PTSD, but I know how to support them through the work. And I know that people don't need to be pushed. It doesn't mean that they need to be cuddled either, you know? So that's also what I hear you saying is like, yes, we've had these methods for centuries and there's value to them. There's value for people facing the uncomfortable and sometimes transcending their limits and what we would say in psychological terms, increasing their window of tolerance. Because we know from a trauma-informed perspective that if you push people beyond their threshold of tolerance, they freeze or they get into fight or flight mode in terms of the nervous system. So the key is not to push people over that edge, but give them a way to gradually tolerate discomfort so that they can increase gradually their window of tolerance and engage with the practice. So that's how I engage with the work. And that's really based on my own experience that having experienced so much re-traumatization that was really not helpful to me as a Butoh dancer, as a human being, that I did not want to inflict that on people, myself.
And what I'm hearing you say is that it also is the responsibility of the teacher to be familiar with who you're working with. And so to have a more flexible technique and approach to teaching. And
yes, and be educated. And if you're not educated about trauma, you cannot have the tools. There's a toolkit that people can acquire to understand how to support people and help people. And that's where it becomes kind of sensitive, right? Because I don't consider myself a therapist. I'm not a trained therapist by any means. But I'm also a teacher who's leading people through experiences that are very, very vulnerable. and that are somatic and yeah. emotional. So I educated myself, and I think that people who work with Bhutto should consider understanding trauma and what happens to people who are in the nervous system with people with PTSD. And like, as you said, it's not just individual. For example, I spoke on the first day of my workshop here of the retreat about the collective trauma of COVID, for example, this collective trauma that we have experienced together. And it's becoming impossible for us as human beings to ignore the impact of trauma collectively, individually. And if we want to heal and save the planet, we have to understand and be really have a lot of compassion and loving kindness in the face of our collective trauma, individual trauma. Mm. How do we help each other heal so that we don't blow up the planet in 6 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest traumas these days is isolation, which has been increased since the pandemic.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And disconnection.
I agree completely.
Yeah.
I see it in New York. I see it in my own life. I see how people are more and more connected through devices, but there's such a great sense of feeling of isolation.
Yeah.
And part of the work that we do in these retreats and workshops is reconnecting people to each other, to themselves, to the collective, so that that sense of isolation can dissipate,
yeah.
whether we are practicing isolation or whether we're imagining it, it's difficult to know, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. I think what I was reminded of this weekend is how we can also cultivate the art of allowing, you know, and not pushing. That there can be an ease to this work or getting in touch with yourself or even healing if we understand how to relax and how to align with these forces that are sort of organic and cosmic in a way. And I think this lineage and this legacy of pushing and it has to come to an end because it's destroying the planet too, is the way I see it. And I think there's a way to surrender that is not so forceful. Yeah, these are acquired habits too. So some of it, of course, pushing through the uncomfortable, yes, but there's also the art of allowing and surrendering. That doesn't have to be so painful, maybe. Yeah. I think we have an attachment to suffering and pain that's really unhealthy as humans.
Mm.
And that joy is within reach. Mm. Ease is within reach.
Mm.
Lately, I like saying happiness because I really feel like that's a very healthy goal, you know? Not just equanimity, but actual joy, you know? And how do we do that? I'm sure that it's not by pushing and hurting ourselves and pushing each other, you know, to limits.
Yeah. Happiness is the goal.
Happiness is the goal.
And as Thich Nhat Hanh says, happiness is here now.
Yes, happiness is here now. I feel that so profoundly. Yeah. It's a currency. It's the only currency that should matter.
Mm-hmm.
Joy, not money, but joy.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about technique.
Mm-hmm.
You emphasize that Bhutto dancers need to be intimate with the arousal of the senses and in touch with performing emotional states in a way that is real for them, and then also to be able to return to homeostasis, perhaps very quickly, in order to flow through the piece and to have some control and be able to respond to sensations and decide, as you say, what they're doing next in effect. And so I'm wondering, is that just a matter of practicing arousal and calming, Are there what are the specific techniques that you use? Because, you know, that also seems like it's directly applicable to everyone's lives. We're triggered by things left and right. There are upsetting situations. You check the news. It arouses certain feelings. And then you need to focus on your child or loved one or work or anything. And so how does that work in Bhutto training?
Mm. So these are tools of self-regulation, basically. We learn to self-regulate. But it's so much easier to do with the body. when the body and mind and when everything is aligned. I think I still struggle to do this in daily life when it's only the mind or the mental or the emotional body that are involved. It's hard to self-regulate. But when the body, when you're actually moving, there are techniques to come back to neutral.
Yeah.
And you just practice them. But of course, you know, we can't dance all day long, although we should be dancing all day long. But it's just techniques of returning to neutral. This is why connecting the body and the mind is so important through movement and so healing and so powerful. Mm-hmm. We are given this amazing tool, but we don't always use it. This said,
amazing tool being
the body.
Yeah.
The body, mm-hmm. the body-mind connection. But this being said, it takes years and decades to be able to self-regulate that way. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you see new students really struggle with. Mm-hmm. Like typically, there's two types of students, people who are kind of shut down and have a difficult time accessing anything, and their journey will be actually burying and accessing gradually their emotions. And there's people who are very highly emotional and sensitive, but then they have a very hard time regulating and controlling. Mm-hmm. And their work will be to learn to self-regulate. Mm-hmm. And everyone meets in the middle after 2 or 3 decades of work, you know. So it's not something that we can think of in terms of days or weeks or even years. Like I'm entering my third decade now, mm-hmm. practicing Buto. And yeah, it's a journey. It's a lifetime practice.
Mm. And what kind of transformation do you see among students in the shorter term?
You see it. You see a blossoming. I saw it this weekend. It's really phenomenal how in a very short amount of time people can dig deep, be present, feel their emotions. It's difficult to describe, but the transformative effects are profound and quick. Mm-hmm. However, for transformation, I feel like is a long game. Mm-hmm. So we can have those quick transformative experiences, but then the question again, that's when we can talk about practice and daily routine, is are people going to integrate this into their lives? Mm-hmm. It's beneficial either way. If people do this for a weekend and they go home and they never practice Buto again, mm-hmm. there will be an opening. Almost like thinking about the brain, a new experience. But we don't just want to have new experiences, because if they're not repeated, they're not integrated mm-hmm. into long-term memories. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we want to build new neural pathways. And you can only build that bridge through digging with a toothpick. You know, it's not a dynamite effect. It's a toothpick walk. And it's much safer that way for the nervous system and the whole body and mind system, by the way. If people open too quickly, it can be dangerous.
What you're saying completely resonates with how we speak of Zen training as well and spiritual development overall, that there may be glimpses, there may be breakthroughs, but ultimately that needs to be integrated, and it needs to be seen over and over, maybe not in that dramatic way, but in more subtle and more subtle ways.
In cultivation,
exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking of that term, the silent observer. I don't know if that's a Hijikata phrase or...
It's a Buto thing.
It's a Buto thing.
All my teachers say it, all of them.
Yeah. And unpack that a little bit, because that is something that I think trips up a lot of meditators. How much should I be observing versus letting go of self-consciousness? There needs to be an awareness, but you know, it really kind of comes down to how silent can my observer be without the awareness going away.
Yeah, and it's a goal, right? It's a destination. Eventually, after decades of practice, you can do both. One of my teachers, who's also very interested in no, told me once that it's a no principle of no theater, that really you have to observe yourself from beyond stage and observe yourself from the audience at the same time, that they can achieve it. I think that people who are beginning or engaging with practice, you can only do one thing at a time. So you need to perhaps alternate, you know. The brain cannot really multitask or alternate between two tasks that it has not mastered. So it's important to master each task very well, and then you're able to alternate and swing back and forth and then maybe be in both places at once. That means in Buto, we practice sensory awareness, being able to really let go and feel the sensations. There's hyper acuity, micro acuity, I want to say almost like, and pay attention. And pay attention. So with mindfulness, because if you sink into it and just like flow, it's a trance dance, it's not Buto. So while we perfect this micro acuity and this sensory awareness, we have to really be able to immediately organize it into movement, let's say with choreography or a task. So we're being given the tools right away to develop both, because that ability to organize is also the ability to observe. Because you cannot organize what you do not observe, what you're not mindful of. So we're developing both side by side. And eventually you just go back and forth really quickly, is my understanding of what being a silent observer and also sinking into the experience is, that dual ability. But yeah, in the beginning, one and the other, one and the other. And then that bridge is being built slowly over time.
You cannot organize what you can't observe.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
What you're not really, really mindful and paying attention of. But luckily with Buto, it's sensations. And there's always new information coming through sensations. So as you are moving, even if you're moving slowly, it's I think it's easy to stay present that way, you know?
Yeah. It also reminds me of a phrase you use: receptivity as a pathway to surrender. And the receptivity, the way I hear that, the receptivity is the feedback of sensations and inner experience, outer stimuli, and being able to receive that as opposed to tuning it out is giving yourself over to, life, maybe?
Yeah, life, as opposed to tuning it out or reacting to it. With tuning it out is a reaction, basically shutting it down or ignoring it. Or we want to cultivate response as opposed to reactions, but we want to feel these reactions as a potential. You know, it's trauma informed work, basically. Yeah. All of this, self regulation, organizing the chaos.
Yeah. Well, I hope we all get there in terms of all these institutions that have ignored the individual's needs or have pushed for so long.
I don't know many people who can be receptive and in surrender and still be angry and fearful. So there's a correlation or a path there.
What I'm taking away from this conversation is also, there's a certain duality between that we need to respect between the individual and the collective, and force and relaxation, and that there's space in life to hold both in balance, would you say?
Yeah, that's a very good way to phrase it. I always feel like Buto is kind of this journey from duality to oneness, oneness to duality. Like as we are living in the 3D physical body, we cannot avoid duality, the experience of it, but we can come to the center. And the center line of the body, speaking of nervous system, is the central nervous system that our spine holds, like this highway of information. But coming to the center, to neutrality, to union in yoga, that's the key. But then we inevitably depart from it. We lose it, we find it. We lose it, we find it. And it's not fighting to stay in the center, because we cannot. It's accepting that this dance will keep happening, and to have flexibility and grace, in that acceptance, that we have to go back and forth. But once in a while, we can come to the center. Once in a while, we can come into oneness. And I don't know, when I dance, sometimes I feel like, wow, this is what it must feel like after we die. that we are this happy and this complete and this one with everything, losing this sense of self and ego. But the path is, we're not dead, we're alive, and we have a destiny in the world and a responsibility to other people and to ourselves. So We have to walk the path of duality.
We have to dance the path.
We have to dance the path, exactly.
Benjamin, it's always such a pleasure speaking.
Such a pleasure to be here, really, truly. Thank you.
Thank you, and looking forward to seeing you again here or elsewhere.
To the next visit, happiness.
Happiness. Here and now, dancing along the path. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the ZMM podcast. If you want to learn more about Zen Mountain Monastery or the Zen Center of New York City and our ongoing programs, visit zmm.org. You can also subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your episodic audio programs. For now, take care.